Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. The battles are coming thick and fast because this is the end of the seventh decade of the 19th century. The British have just been defeated at the Battle of Hlobane on the 28th of March. But there's been so much skop, skiet and donner, it's time to reflect on matters further southwest before we buzz back to Zululand next episode. In the Transvaal, resistance to British rule was slowly setting, like mortar hardening between stones. The scattered grievances of the Boers beginning to cohere into something firmer and more deliberate. Far to the west, Kimberley glittered with a different intensity, fortunes were rising from the dust, deals were struck in the heat and noise, and the great hole in the earth swallowed men and money alike. Yet, beneath the clangour of the picks and the shimmer of the diamonds, another current was moving, for even as the town prospered, a sequence of personal tragedies was about to cast along the shadow of Kimberley, shaping not only its mood but the hardening temper of one of its most ambitious young men. Cecil John Rhodes would endure a series of personal blows in the years ahead. These losses did not soften him. If anything, they seemed to harden an already melancholic temperament. One by one, the setbacks accumulated, and the young speculator, who often appeared distant in manner, would in time come to embody the ruthless vanity and moral ambiguity that marked the diamond fields and the empire they fed. The string of tragedies began with his brother Herbert. It was he who had come to South Africa first and started the cotton farm at Richmond near Pietermaritzburg, and it was he who had impulsively upped and off to Kimberley to look for diamonds. Once these had been unearthed and he had convinced young Cecil to join him there, he upped and off once again to the Eastern Transvaal where gold was discovered. After a while he tired of that life and began gun-running from Delagoa Bay to the Pedi people, then roved about into northern Mozambique and what is Malawi today. He hunted the next gold find everywhere he went, a mad Victorian searching for his personal treasure. Herbert was almost the exact opposite of Cecil. He mixed with all peoples, Africans, Boers, even Jews, they said. He was the life and soul of the party, while Cecil's social skills were deformed, they were so deficient. Herbert was on the hunt for gold when he stopped at the village of a Kololo chief on the upper Zambezi River, somewhere between modern-day Botswana and Zambia. Always a man for a good time, he was holding forth in the village one night when a demijohn of rum nearby caught fire and then exploded, killing the party animal Herbert, who died of both burn and shrapnel wounds. A dramatic but perhaps fitting end. To Cecil John Rhodes, this wasn't just a tragedy. It was proof of the savagery he already believed in. He didn't see an accident, he saw a target. He pointed the finger directly at the Kololo chief for his brother's death, claiming it was a mystery whether he was killed and burned or burned accidentally. But let's be clear, the facts were straightforward. There was no homicide here. Yet Rhodes Jr. flatly refused to accept that his brother could have died in such a common accidental way. In his mind, it had to be murder. The non-empathetic Cecil betrayed no emotion when he received the news of Herbert's demise, and in a letter to his aunt he wrote, "What a sad affair Herbert's death is. I send you the paper with a full account of it." It would take 20 years before Cecil dealt with this blow, following which he had a marble statue of his brother erected on the bank of the Shire River in the UK, where it still stands today. Kimberley, meanwhile, had grown into an honest-to-goodness Wild West frontier town, full of drunkards and cowboys and miners, prostitutes and flashy fly-by-nights, tricksters and, of course, dubious politicians. More about that in a moment. First, Anthony Trollope. He visited South Africa in 1877 as a fading author, ideas drying up, still managing to write 40 pages a day, come rain, shine, summer or winter. It was time to regenerate his flagging fortunes by doing what struggling authors often do. They write a travel book. "To do South Africa," he wrote pompously, "had for years past been on my mind, till at last there was a growing consciousness that I was becoming too old for any more such doings." The British annexation of the Transvaal in 1877 had reinvigorated his action plan. He wanted to inspect the latest land seized by the Empire. Before he left, many warned he was departing on a most dangerous mission. The trip was long and arduous. South Africa's climate was harsh. Dangerous objects would block his path, like hustlers and armed men. Sounds like a fairly modern trip then. He arrived in October, 62-year-old red-faced bald man with spectacles, as James Russell Lowell described him. And he also described him as an underbred Englishman. Good grief. One of his friends said he was crusty, quarrelsome, wrong-headed, prejudiced, obstinate, although kind-hearted. Trollope was stunned by Kimberley, let's say more shocked. Having survived the supposedly dangerous trip without incident, first thing he noticed were the walls around the black workers' camps and curfew laws that kept non-white workers out of town. He also noticed a great deal of capricious flogging and the segregation of compounds, each enclosure unroofed but covered with wire netting like a zoo that prevented things from being thrown both out and in. Sheds and huts lay inside these walled prisons, no spirit alcohol allowed. Somehow, though, illicit diamonds were being smuggled in and out of these compounds. Workers went as far as cutting themselves and hiding the jewels in the wounds. Others fed the stones to dogs, then walked them out of town, killed them there, and removed the valuable gemstones. Buyers were traders in town who actively encouraged what was known as illicit diamond buying, IDB. In one case, a Boer buyer from the Free State submitted to a body search after he'd bought illicit stones. Then he ran off, leapt on his horse, and galloped to the Orange River, swam across holding his horse's tail, and made it to the bank on the other side. That was the border. Kimberley police could not cross into Boer territory. In full view of said Kimberley police, the illicit diamond-buying Boer pulled out his revolver, shot his horse, and as the gobsmacked police watched, slit the poor animal's stomach open and retrieved his illicit gems. A popular song would often be sung in the local pubs. Over the Free State line, whatever is yours is mine. By now, the salaries of white workers outstripped blacks by 400% or more, whereas in the early days, income was fairly evenly distributed. Disease spread quickly here. By 1878, the death rate exceeded that of Calcutta, said to be the empire's most afflicted city. What had begun to emerge in this town of Sodom and Gomorrah was the first sign of the urban climate of the future in South Africa. Never be familiar or laugh with him, said some. Trollope had a slightly different view, saying, I have felt I was looking at 3,000 or 4,000 growing Christians. On the whole, though, his trip was not a delight. His book, South Africa, was published in two volumes in 1878, and of Kimberley he writes, The place itself was distasteful to me in the extreme. The meat was bad, the butter inedible, vegetables a rarity. He said his thermometer read 160 degrees in the sun, which is an impossible 71 degrees centigrade, so that was a slight exaggeration. The avarice of the place, it was everywhere, he moaned. Diggers' families who would turn the dirt four times just for a hint of profit. Like most, however, he was gradually enticed into this Victorian casino town, mentally flipping between revulsion and curiosity. Trollope began to wander around every part of Kimberley Mine, already the largest man-made excavation in the world, asking questions and taking notes. The scene inside this deep hole in these years was almost like a Piranesi etching. It was as if some diabolically ingenious architect had contrived a house of 500 rooms, not one of which should be on the same floor, and to and from none of which should there be a pair of stairs, or a door, or a window. At first, he wrote in a patronizing tone about the thousands of workers, particularly the indigenous workers, but that tone begins to fade later in his writing. The brute system of hypocrisy and money hunger was all too present. And although you could say he was a man of his time, he was also a neutral observer. The stranger in South Africa will constantly be told that the coloured man will not work, he notes, and that this is one insuperable cause by which the progress of the country will be impeded. Yet during his whole sojourn in the country, he will see all the work of the world around him being done by the hands of coloured people. By coloured, he means, of course, black. The misuse of the law was something that grated him, one law for Europeans, the other for Africans. There can be no good done till the two stand before the law exactly on the same ground. It was a comment he was to make which was an uncanny forecast for the coming of the De Beers Empire. He found it odd that the diamond mines could contain the operations of a large number of separate speculators. It is so completely one that you are driven to think it must be the property of one firm. The big hole of Kimberley was going to become the property of one firm. In November 1878, the citizens of Kimberley awoke to find blue and white ribbons fluttering all over the ward. It was election year, and everyone knew what blue and white meant. These were the ribbons of Barney Bonatto's racehorses. Bonatto is one of those characters of South African history, a kind of steampunk Englishman, running the infamous London Hotel in Kimberley, where boxers mixed it up with vaudeville. Bonatto brothers were more famous for yielding diamonds of the highest quality, a different kind of magic. Bonatto's real name was Bonatto Isaacs, and his elder brother Harry reverted to that surname in order to be recognized as a financier, not Barney, whose success did not produce a corresponding dignity. He dressed in bantam style, including plumage, and dropped his H's like a man scattering gold coins before the multitudes. When the editors of the Diamond News heard he was running for a position on the town council, they cracked up. Their satirists had pictured him as a clown who was nominated for the mere sake of bringing the whole municipal council into contempt. Like many natural politicians before or since, Barney knew how to reach his ward, and that, of course, was through the promise of free drinks and pocket money. The cackling editors of the Diamond News stopped chuckling, but it was too late. Bribery in its most direct and objectionable form, they fulminated in an edition of the Diamond News. On election day, Barney's opponent, middle-aged teetotaler George Bottomley, took an early lead. A reporter for the Diamond News then noted, "After a little while, however, a file of 10 men appeared in an answer to the usual question, 'How do you vote?' They replied, 'Plump for Barney.'" In other words, they'd been briefed to vote for Barney. By late morning, a veritable succession of drunks and stooges had pitched up and plumped for Barney. Eventually, Bottomley conceded. As Stefan Kampfer notes in his wonderful book, The Last Empire, Bottomley had not been defeated by a man or a party. He had lost to a purse. First on Showbird Barney's list was the sewerage system, and almost to spite the press, he turned out to be an excellent and hard-working councillor, the most effective the town had seen. The Kimberley's cesspits were fermenting and bubbling up an invitation to the plague. Black workers who died were buried three deep in shallow graves and without coffins. Seepage crept out of these diabolical pits and into the groundwater. This was hell on earth, and Barney was just the kind of hellraiser to fix it. Of all deaths in 1878, dysentery had killed 51. 36 others died of bronchitis, pneumonia, and pleurisy. All could be traced to Kimberley's earth, air, and water. Bonatto fixed the paupers' burial pits, then lobbied for a cleaner city. He stumped around town and, according to sources, always collected a little backsheesh for his efforts. The Diamond News on the scene sarcastically commented that Barney was a fully-fledged town council, clad in check trousers, etc., touting for the assistant market master, holding up cabbages and other vegetables to the gaze of an admiring public, and finally returning home with a cabbage under each arm, a pocket full of carrots. The buzz he created was noted by a number of Kimberley's budding entrepreneurs. The first to copy him was J.B. Robinson. At 37 years old, was as rich as Barney, even more womanizer. Most afternoons he could be found lolling outside his office, ogling young women as they strolled by. That all apparently came to an end in late 1878 when J.B. Robinson announced his engagement to Rebecca Ferguson, the respectable daughter of a diamond field pioneer. They were off to Europe to be married. Perhaps when he returned, thought his competitors, he would be a changed, domesticated man, soft and gentle. And then he returned. The only thing that had changed was that he'd grown a black beard. Otherwise, his omnipresent pith helmet remained perched on his head for 16 hours a day. "Perhaps he wore it to bed," said some snidely behind his back. He was as stingy as before, never buying anyone a drink, and desperately jealous of Barney Bonatto. That's why he announced his candidacy as mayor of Kimberley. The election was close. He challenged the results in the courts, and he won the appeal. Once officially mayor, he concentrated on propaganda, because he used the Diamond Field Independent newspaper as his mouthpiece. That wasn't a surprise. He once owned it, and he still controlled it. "I am no negrophilist," he intoned in one puff piece. That meant he was no lover of black people. Though I am in favour of the natives being treated with justice and humanity, he said they must first have discipline instilled in them. They must respect the laws of meum and tuum, mine and yours. Fascinated by all this public froth, Cecil John Rhodes took his own notes. He was already thirsting for power, and now he realized there were two routes. From Barney Bonata, he learnt the value of politics, and from J.B. Robinson, he came to understand the uses of journalism and propaganda. Rhodes wanted something much bigger, and that was a seat in the Cape Parliament. He ran for representative of a rural territory, Barkly West, which was a mistake. When he appeared at a meeting, one of the local Boers told him off. In the first place, you are too young. In the second, you look so damnably like an Englishman. Rhodes, unlike certain modern politicians, listened. Age? Well, he'd have to wizen up a bit. The looks? He could wise up. He began wearing rough clothing, walking and riding around the fields like a farmer, assuring anyone who'd listen that his ancestors were keepers of cows. Encouraged by the soti, who was less soot and more pepper, some of the Dutch farmers changed their minds about the damned Englishman. First stage of campaign complete. Time for second stage. And here, it may surprise many listeners, but he turned to black South Africans, because at this time in our history, blacks could vote in the Cape. All they had to do was show they had enough cash. The Cape qualified franchise. Every voter had to prove they either had £25 or more in value of land, or prove they received at least £50 a year in income. After dispersing black workers with an unknown sum of money, 250 turned up to vote for Rhodes on election day, and largely because of this support, he won. It is truly amazing that Cecil John Rhodes won his seat in the Cape Parliament because of black voters, and would go on to hold that seat in periods of triumph, disgrace, and depression until the day he died. While all of this was going on, his new friend Dr. Leander Starr Jameson was egging him on. A 25-year-old Scotsman, a brilliant London career in medicine was awaiting when he changed direction, literally, and boarded a ship for South Africa. Led here, like so many other, by an older brother who sent him a present from Kimberley, an uncut diamond. When he arrived in the seething city of sin, he slotted in immediately, recognizing it was his ticket to an easy life. The roustabout atmosphere lured him in. He met Cecil Rhodes and fell in with the quirky future colonialist. I soon admitted to myself that for sheer natural power, I'd never met a man to come near to Cecil Rhodes. Not that they were lovers. Oh, no, Dr. Jameson was a prodigious indulger of the opposite sex, and being a doctor gave him ideal opportunities to indulge. Described as short but bright, with the energy of Napoleon and a devious charm, his escapades became legendary, particularly as he was much sought after by the middle-class families of the city. One day, a well-known businessman, who shall remain nameless, approached him saying his life was excellent. He was happy. All was going swimmingly, except his wife had not presented him with a tiny image of himself. Dr. Jim, as he was known, was consulted, who probed the apparent malaise with significant energy. And hey presto, before the year was out, on the 1st of April too, the businessman became the proud father of bouncing twins. The doctor was indeed the giver of life. Almost two decades later, Leander Starr Jameson was to become the taker of life. His deviousness apparently knew no bounds. Fate and the Boers were going to bring Dr. Jim back to earth with a prodigious thud. Next, we're back with Cetshwayo and Chelmsford, and the destruction of the Zulu kingdom is at hand. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load updates about various episodes. You can sign up for my newsletter there. Until next, au revoir.